Ryan, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Susan Cannon Ryan, appearing on behalf of Appellant Ann Morris, who's the Chapter 13 trustee and the appellant. The centerpiece of every Chapter 13 case is the plan. A key element of every successful plan is the plan payment. The question before the court today is where you have a debtor who enjoys above median income, what amount must be dedicated to the plan payment? The trustee's position is that the forward-looking approach, as announced by the Supreme Court in Hamilton versus Lanning, is the approach that must be applied to determine the projected disposable income that is dedicated to the plan. That's the amount of money that's going to be repaid to creditors. The plan filed by the debtor in this case not only provided a periodic payment, but also shed the debtor of three payments on secured articles, which the debtor did not intend to make further payments on, two all-terrain vehicles, and a pickup truck, which was in the possession of an ex-boyfriend. Now, when the debtor filled out the means test, which is the means of calculating the disposable income as defined by the statute, the debtor took those deductions. Taking those deductions reduced her income to less than zero, to a negative amount. When she filed her plan, she said, no, I'll not continue to make those payments. So the trustee objected to this plan for the reason that it was clear that a change had occurred by the plan, which meant the debtor would not continue to make those payments, does not have that expense, and therefore, accordingly, has more money which can be devoted to the plan. The bankruptcy court, in its written opinion, acknowledged that the trustee's position was logical and reached the result that the court would prefer.
Why did you couch your opening comment in above median income? Did you say that?
I did, Your Honor.
Does it make a difference?
It does.
Okay. Why does that make a difference?
Well, if it were a below median income debtor, then the amount of plan payment would be determined by the I and J schedules, which are filed by the debtor.
Okay.
In this case, the I and J schedules would not reflect any payment on these secured obligations. So the forward-looking approach, in effect, lines above median debtors up with below median debtors. So we're looking at actual expenses during the life of the plan. The debtor's plan obviously did not propose payments on these, or the trustee would not have objected. The trustee believes that the proper way to analyze or determine projected disposable income, and that's the term of the statute, projected disposable income, is to start with a properly completed means test and then look to see if there's any changes that are known or which are virtually certain to take place during the life of the plan, and then use those changes if necessary to make an adjustment over the life of the plan. In Lanning, the court found that this was in line with prior BAPSIPA practice. This is the way courts had construed it beforehand. The Lanning court found that the term projected disposable income was not defined by statute, so that this forward interpretation was in line with prior practice. It also found that it would avoid an absurd result, which might be available through a mechanical approach. The mechanical approach was what was applied by the bankruptcy court in this case, and the bankruptcy court did not have the benefit of the Lanning decision at that time. Lanning came later in time. The Lanning decision, the Supreme Court analyzed the forward-looking approach and the mechanical approach and said the mechanical approach could lead to absurd results and rejected that and adopted the forward-looking approach. The question also arises,
is it your view that the bankruptcy court may account for future changes or must account for future changes?
I believe the language of Lanning is may account for future changes.
And so the court wouldn't necessarily have to, if the court acknowledged that it could make an adjustment, you don't argue that they necessarily had to.
In some cases that may be true, Your Honor. However, the Supreme Court continued in the ransom decision where they echoed the same rationale and found that in order to deduct an expense, it's necessary that that expense be necessary. That's the language of the statute, necessary. and found that in ransom the debtor had answered their own question by saying, I'll not make the payment. The court said, well, therefore it's not necessary, and that you cannot deduct a fictitious expense.
Why does the debtor make that statement? Why did the debtor in this case make that statement at this point rather than just not do it in the future? Was it to reject the contract or something? Why did they inform the court they would not make those future payments?
Because it's part of the plan in this case, and the plan is a very flexible document that not only provides a periodic payment, but allows a debtor to come to the court and rework or reorganize their financial circumstances. So if they're overcommitted or have committed
on
something
unnecessary. Yeah, this wouldn't be overcommitted. This wouldn't be overcommitted. But why would the debtor come in at this point and announce to the court? Why wouldn't the debtor just not make the payments?
This is how they make the announcement. They'll not make the payments. It's through the operation of the plan. There's a portion of the plan that says, are you surrendering anything?
Because otherwise, in violation of the plan, if they don't live up with what's required in the plan?
The plan is required to treat each and every secured claim that's filed in the schedules. So the plan has to designate.
Yeah, but I'm just asking a quick question. What's the remedy for the debtor who doesn't live up to the plan?
The court can't confirm it. If it doesn't treat all the debts, if they fail to live up to the plan, the court can dismiss it on motion of a party in interest.
It could be dismissed.
Yes, sir. I see that my time is up.
Thank you. Ms. Cox.
Morning. I would first like to address the question that you all just raised, and then I wanted to make four quick points about I'm addressing only the issue related to the surrendered ATVs. Four quick points that I'll address after I answer the question is that Lanning rejected the bankruptcy court's mechanical approach to calculating projected disposable income. Derone and Turner, those are the Sixth and Seventh Circuit decisions, reached the opposite conclusion using an approach that's consistent with Lanning, reached the opposite conclusion as the bankruptcy court did on this precise issue. This approach that was used in Derone, Turner, and Lanning is, in the government's view, a fair and neutral approach that advances the purposes of the statute to require debtors to repay the most they can afford. And the bankruptcy court did not want to reach that decision. It says in its opinion, I believe it's on page 3, that the result of allowing, it didn't think it was a logical result to allow these deductions for these secured debt payments that the debtor wouldn't actually pay. And it preferred not to do that, but it thought that the statute required that result. So addressing the question you asked about whether the court may take account of these changes or whether the court has to take account of the changes, it's the government's position that the court has to take account of changes that are known or virtually certain. Derone interpreted the statute that way. There was no discussion in any of these cases. Well, we know, or we're virtually certain there's a change here, and we're going to, but, you know, we'll think about whether we want to apply it or not. And the statute itself, 1325B, is clear that if the plan does not pay all of the unsecured creditors in full, and either the trustee or an unsecured creditor objects to the plan, that the debtor has to commit all of his projected disposable income to the repayment of unsecured creditors. There's no discretion there. And if the bankruptcy court were to look at a known or virtually certain change and just turn a blind eye to it, that would undermine the purpose of Section 1325B. I think really the answer to the reason why the holding in Lanning uses the word may is because in Supreme Court practice, the Supreme Court selects a particular question. There's a particular question presented to which the court limits its holding. And in Lanning, the question presented, and you can find this on the Supreme Court's website under the Lanning docket, the question presented was whether the bankruptcy court may consider evidence suggesting that their income or expenses have changed. And the Supreme Court answered that question, said, yes, you may consider these questions as long as they are known or virtually certain. So Lanning interpreted the means test to reflect a debtor's actual ability to repay.
You think that question was framed for the party, framing the question to win, to have a better chance of winning the case?
No, I think, honestly, I think it had to do with the procedural posture of the case. In Lanning, the bankruptcy court did take the changed circumstances into account. And when it came up to the Supreme Court, the question the parties were asking was whether that was reversible error. Whether it was reversible error.
Could not do that.
Exactly. That's correct, Your Honor. In Lanning interpreted the means test to reflect the debtor's actual ability to pay, and it rejected this mechanical approach that produced what it called senseless results, which denied creditors payments that debtors could easily afford. And Durone and Turner both took the same approach to projected disposable income as Lanning, and the Turner court reasoned that these payments on secured debts were intended to adjust the rights between secured creditors and unsecured creditors. But if no payments were actually being made by the debtor, then neither the secured creditor or the unsecured creditor benefited. The only thing that happened was the debtor was being enriched by these payments that it wasn't actually making and didn't have to make. Durone actually applied Lanning and found that under Lanning, that the debtor's expressed an undisputed intent to surrender property was a known or virtually certain change that had to be accounted for in the debtor's projected disposable income. This case is just like Durone, it's just like Turner, and it merits the same result. Lanning, the approach taken in Lanning, Durone, and Turner is a neutral approach that brings truth to the process. Sometimes changes in a debtor's income or expenses may cause its disposable income to rise, in which case the required plan payments will increase. But you could just as easily have a change in the debtor's income or expenses that caused the debtor's disposable income to fall. And in that case, the debtor would have decreased plan payments. So either way, the debtor is required to pay the most that the debtor can afford, and that's just as the statute intended. Finally, permitting Ms. Quigley to take the deduction for the secured debt payments on the surrendered vehicles allowed her to shield money that she didn't actually need for her necessary living expenses. And the bankruptcy court, it's clear from the bankruptcy court's opinion that was not the result that the bankruptcy court wanted to reach. But it's equally clear from Lanning and Durone and Turner that the bankruptcy court didn't have to reach that decision. So a reversal in this case would simply achieve the result that the bankruptcy court wanted to achieve
so
in the first instance.
So what are we supposed to tell the district court or the bankruptcy court to do on reversal?
To take into account to not allow the deductions for the secured.
So then we're making the determination in the first instance?
No.
It sounds like we are. We're saying don't take.
Well, our view, the government's view of the statute and of Durone is that that's the required result. This is a known and certain change. There's no dispute about that. I see my time is run. Shall I finish?
You can answer the question.
Answer
sure.
The question. There's no dispute about that. This is a known change and one that, in the government's view, is required under Section 1325B. And in addition, we already have an indication of what the bankruptcy court would have done had it known that it had that opportunity.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. McNeil.
May it please the court, I'm William Andrew McNeil and I represent the amicus curiae ECAST Settlement Corporation, which is an unsecured claimant against Ms. Quigley's estate in bankruptcy. My client joins with the Chapter 13 trustee and the amicus United States trustee in urging that this court reverse the courts below and require that the debtor repay to her creditors that which statute compels and which the Congress clearly intended and
prevent
her.
Are there any other factors that the bankruptcy judge could take into account account that might affect whether or not the relief you seek should be granted? Are there any other equitable factors and any other legal issues that would affect that decision?
Of course, Your Honor. It would seem that...
Of course, yes, or of course, no.
Oh, beg your pardon, Your Honor. Yes, I believe there are. It would seem inequitable and even counterintuitive to the purpose of limiting a debtor's expenses to those which are reasonably necessary for her maintenance and support or for the production of income.
So we wouldn't order him to disallow it. We would just send it back and say, what?
My client would urge this court to find that the debt service that is paid or that would have been paid on collateral that has been surrendered by the debtor, that debt service is no longer required and should no longer be deducted in the calculation of projected disposable income. That awards a windfall to the debtor that's inequitable.
But you just said there were other equitable factors right, which the court could consider. That's what Chief Judge asked you. In other words, might there be, you said there were other equitable factors. I don't know
yes,
if that's what you meant
second
to say,
but
that's what you said. So why would we then say the full amount must be deducted? She didn't get allowance for that full amount.
Sure, Your Honor. A second equitable factor would be to avoid encouraging debtors to engage in incurring eve of bankruptcy secured debt with the plan or the goal in mind of surrendering that collateral, but then, based upon the laws that exist before this hearing, but then retaining for the debtor's own purposes and denying to the creditors those monies. That's another equitable factor.
I understood the question to mean, were there other equitable factors which the court could take into account in deciding whether the full amount should be disallowed or some amount should be disallowed? And if that wasn't the question, that's my question. It follows what Judge Motz just asked. Do we decide that this amount must be disallowed, or do we remand it for the court to decide?
My client would urge that the amount must be disallowed.
See, what confused me is in response to Judge Traxler's question, you said, yes, there are other equitable factors, which sounds like we don't direct anything, but the bankruptcy court considers those other equitable factors.
Forgive me for misunderstanding your question.
But all of us, I think, thought of
it. I'll try to restate it as compactly and as clearly as I can. My client believes that the law dictates that debt service that on surrendered collateral may not be used, the amounts of that debt service may not be used to adjust a debtor's or to calculate a debtor's projected disposable income. The law requires that result. Secondly, it would be inequitable even to run against that position because it would unfairly deprive creditors and would unfairly award a windfall to a debtor for expenses that she doesn't pay.
Is your point that the issue before us, sort of we talked about how the issue is framed for the Supreme Court, the issue before us is simply whether or not under these facts at this point is she allowed credit for the payment of this expense which doesn't exist. And we would say she's not allowed. That would be our ruling. And then the court, as the plan continues, if it is continuing, could make further determinations on other factors as other changed circumstances happen?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Couture, did I say that right?
Coder.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Kelly Coder. I'm appearing here today for the debtor, Susan Quigley, and I'm asking that the court affirm the decision of the district court. The plain language of the statute at issue, which determines the deductions for secured debts on the means test, does not make a differentiation between collateral to be retained and collateral to be surrendered. The means test instructs debtors to deduct from their current income or from their average monthly income payments for these secured debts. And the statute states that those secured debts shall be calculated as the total of all amounts scheduled as contractually due to secured creditors in each of the 60 months following the petition.
What do we do about Lanning?
Well, Lanning was dealing with, it says they may account for changes in a debtor's projected
right,
disposable income.
But Lanning wasn't the law when this was decided, right?
Right. That's supposed to...
So why at the very least don't we remand for reconsideration in light of Lanning?
The
That is the law now.
Yes.
We apply the law as it exists in front of us.
The language in Lanning states that it should apply in unusual cases that a court may go further and account for these changes. And Lanning was certainly an unusual case. In that case, the debtor had received one-time buyout from her prior employer, which inflated her income on the means test, which was listed at $5,343 a month. However, her current monthly income was only about $1,900. It was a difference of over $3,000. So looking strictly at the means test in that case, the debtor never could have afforded to pay what the means test was calling for her to pay. However, in this case, in Quigley, these are not unusual circumstances. The two ATV payments are made total $163.33.
The dollar amount doesn't make it significant one way or the other. It's significant within the state that's at issue here.
It can be significant because the small amount that we're talking about in this case can easily be absorbed by her actual expenses as listed on Schedule J that are not either fully accounted for on the means test or are not listed for on the means test. For example, her actual rent payment is $500 per month, but on the means test she was only allotted $412. And
$471 a month is 50% of her unsecured debt, right?
I believe so.
Sounds pretty significant in this case.
Well, if this court or the bankruptcy court were to look at her actual expenses as listed on Schedule J, she would not be able to afford an additional $163 per month. She's already paying the maximum amount that she can afford, which was the intent of Congress when it enacted the law in 2005.
Is this an argument, though, that you make to the bankruptcy court? I mean, I just don't understand how we can get by a remand in light of Lanning.
Well, I think the plain language of the statute at issue, Lanning doesn't change the plain language of the statute.
No, but Lanning's direct holding is that you may take these things into account. And the bankruptcy court didn't know that
right at
the time, right?
That's true. I don't think this is a case, an unusual or an exceptional case as anticipated by Lanning. In addition, the ransom case at issue, or that was mentioned by the appellant, that was dealing with interpretation of a different statute or a different section of the means test that dealt with applicable expenses as it related to the IRS national standards and local standards. And to take that holding of ransom directly to and apply it directly to this case at hand would be to ignore the plain language of the statute at issue here, which directs how payments on secured debts are to be calculated. Furthermore, if this court were to follow the ruling of the district court and affirm this case,
what language of the statute would be ignored? What plain language of the statute would be ignored?
The plain language that deals with how secured debts are to be calculated on the means test, which was that language that it shall be calculated as a total of all amounts scheduled as contractually due in the 60 months following the date of petition.
What
the petition
would they
divided
do if she's not going to pay them?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Would they be due if she's now announced she's not going to pay them?
Well, she's still contractually obligated on the date of petition.
I know that, but could it be that when you understand that it wouldn't contradict, it seems to me you can make an argument it doesn't contradict the statute if in fact is you're saying what that means is what's due and payable.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's not going to pay it, then that doesn't necessarily contradict the statute, I don't think. Do you?
Well, that's not necessarily, no. I agree with you. The fact is, though, even if this court would allow debtors to continue to take that deduction on the means test, that doesn't preclude a creditor or a trustee from objecting to the plan if the debtor's expenses on Schedule J are excessive or are not reasonably necessary for a debtor's support.
Well, why aren't they excessive if she's claiming the deduction on expense she's not actually doing? Why wouldn't that sort of be excessive?
Well, in some cases, since this is such a small amount of $163, as I pointed out, it's an amount that can be like eaten up with her other actual expenses
well,
that are not.
Well, it must matter to somebody because we're sitting here with a bunch of lawyers arguing to us. It matters to somebody.
Right. Well, in In some of these cases, for example, in Jerome that was mentioned earlier, that was dealing with a $2,700 deduction. And of course, for...
So you would have us means test the amount of the payment not to be made? We somehow have some test to measure how much was involved?
That's where the issue would lie. But as I mentioned, a creditor or the trustee could, if they feel that... If you take this deduction on the means test for the $2,700, obviously on the Schedule I or Schedule J, you're going to have to justify where that extra income is going.
And let me say this. If, in fact, the law now is this may be considered, the fact that she's not going to pay, that may be considered. Mm-hmm. And in a bankruptcy court in equity, why isn't it only fair at a minimum that it has to be considered? What's fair about not considering? Now, maybe you, in a circumstance, you could convince the court everything you're telling us, that you undercalculated her expenses, that you really need to give us more credit for something else. I don't know about all that, but where is the fairness in not considering that change in circumstance that she, that amount of debt is no longer going to come from her? What's fair about not considering that?
Well, you have a point. Maybe Lanning should apply in... You know, in every case, the court could look
except
at
this
it.
Case.
Well, I think the end result, even if the court would apply Lanning, they would find that Ms. Quigley is already paying the maximum amount that she can afford.
Maybe, but we don't determine that, right?
Right. So, as I mentioned, even if these deductions were disallowed, Ms. Quigley is already paying the maximum amount that she can afford.
But if we decided that this had to be taken, that Lanning suggested that the court was wrong in saying the fact that she's not going to repay this debt cannot be taken into account. If we said, yes, it can be taken into account, why wouldn't we just go ahead and order the court to adjust for this amount of money? I mean, why wouldn't we, the Fourth Circuit, just go, you made a mistake, you said you could take him into account, you can take him into account, take him into account.
Well, Ms. Quigley couldn't afford to pay this extra money that it would be ordered if Lanning were to apply. She wouldn't be able to afford that extra money if this court were to order the bankruptcy court to take that amount into account.
Well, I think she'd have to make a showing. If the bankruptcy court has, it seems to me, under Lanning, it has to take it into account.
Right.
Well, then you can make your argument. But
well, it would seem that Lanning would only apply, like I said, in these exceptional or unusual cases. And I would argue
okay,
that this...
Okay, so let's just assume, for purposes of our argument right now, that we think that this is exceptional or unusual enough to make Lanning... give the bankruptcy court the right to consider this, may taking this into account. Then what happens?
Well, the court may end up having to remand this case then for future consideration.
Why wouldn't we do what Judge Shedd said?
I don't think this is an exceptional case that falls under this Lanning directive.
By the way, looking at the numbers, am I missing something? If the plan accounted for a payment of so much and she's not going to pay that, well, how does that affect anything? That's no loss. That's no net loss to her, is it? If she says, I'm not going to pay $300 anymore, well, the fact that that $300 gets redirected to somebody else or somewhere else, how does that net negatively affect her? I may be missing something. She has a pot of money,
right.
And from that pot of money, she's allowed to keep some part for her expenses,
mm-hmm.
And the rest is to be paid on debts.
Correct.
The fact that the amount to be paid on debt may be shifted from one debtor to another, how does that, if I understand that correctly, how does that negatively impact her?
It would increase the amount that she is to pay to her unsecured creditors.
What difference does that make?
She was surrendering the ATVs because she could no longer afford to pay.
I know that, but did the plan call for her to pay X amount of money to the secured creditors?
No.
It didn't?
No.
It didn't?
No, it was, okay. And in this amount that it was accounted for on the means test, that would increase the amount that she would pay to her unsecured creditors.
So it would be a net loss? She would have to pay out more money?
Yes.
Oh, I got you, because they had the security. Okay.
Okay. So in summary, I would ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court because Lanning is not directly applicable in this case. And like I said, the ransom case is not necessarily applicable here either because it dealt with a different section of the means test. Does the court have any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Coder. Ms. Cannon-Ryan?
Maybe you could take a crack at what we're supposed to be doing in the order. What relief would you like here?
I would like to see that.
And reversal is not a satisfactory answer.
I would like to see it reversed and the court apply ransom to say that this is not a reasonable and necessary expense because it is not being paid. Therefore, the debtors answered that question. It's not necessary. Therefore, it can't be deducted. And this court should reverse with direction that the bankruptcy court look at this again under the forward-looking approach as announced in Lanning, and that the following ransom, the bankruptcy court should disallow those expenses that she's not going to pay. You have
been saying that no other factors the bankruptcy court could take into consideration in making that final decision.
In a hypothetical bankruptcy case, there are many equitable factors that could be taken into account.
In this case,
I know of no others. And this case had reached the point where those factors should have been brought before the bankruptcy court. Now, granted, this case was heard by the bankruptcy court before Lanning. So the debtors were not particularly focused on other equitable.
I was wondering about that. What about that? I don't know what they might be, but that's a fair point. Should they be given the opportunity to be able to at least make the argument on the necessary expenses or for the whole new recalculation? Or how broad is the discretion, and what will the court be deciding when it goes back?
It doesn't seem to me that's inconsistent with your argument. I mean, you could say that we say that you apply Lanning and you have to look at the forward-looking, but whatever other arguments they have, they can make.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, that would seem to me to be the...
And there could be many other...
This is a court of equity.
It is. And perhaps the debtor would have lost a job, be reemployed at a lower amount, something of that sort. But on the question of the expenses, which were the issue brought before this court, I think all the facts are in. These are payments that the debtor is not going to make on unnecessary ATVs and on a truck that's being used by someone else. So that question's settled. The question of whether the debtor might raise other issues, it is certainly a genuine question for the bankruptcy court to look at. And in Lanning, I think the language is that the bankruptcy court would be the party, the body to determine whether or not those changes are significant.
But in Lanning, didn't the Supreme Court say the bankruptcy court may account? In other words, they didn't send it back and say you must account for this change.
Well, I think Lanning says you have to apply the forward-looking approach, but when you do that, then, court, you may determine whether you in this case there are factors which are known or virtually certain to occur which need to be applied. So the court may make a change. The court's not required to make a change. But I think in every case, the court has to see whether the forward-looking approach would make a change to the projected disposable income.
So the bankruptcy court there had used the forward-looking approach. Is that correct?
In Lanning.
In Lanning. And
that's
the Supreme
correct,
Court affirmed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that there wasn't, they don't have the situation.
I see that my time is up.
Thank you. I'll ask the